Hello, welcome to Growing Wild, sponsored by Infinity Foods. I'm Charlotte Pett, and you're listening to Radio Reverb on 97.2 FM. Today's show is going to be a highlights package. I've had so many brilliant people on throughout the year, I thought we'd revisit some of them. So first of all, we'll have a song, and then we'll crack on, because there's quite a few people to get through today. This is At Last by Etta James. That was At Last by Etta James. Many a person's first dance at a wedding, I reckon. So in this show, we're going to have, like I said, it's a highlight show. So I've gone back through a lot of the packages and interviews that I did across the year. There's just been so many brilliant people on. It was incredibly hard to narrow it down and just pick a few. I mean, I value everyone that's been on, so thank you very much to those that have. So first up, we're going to have Nick Lear on, taking us on his winter bird walk. I went and saw him in January in some woodland out in East Sussex, and we went for a little stroll through the woods and just had a look around at what birds were doing their thing. I think sometimes we can forget that there's still quite a lot of activity going on in January. We sort of hunker down and hibernate, but it's just that thing of going outside and having a look and seeing what's still around and alive and cracking on. So this is me and Nick walking very quietly through some woods.
Great spotted woodpecker, uses its beak. Just here, you can hear some tits and a robin. Yeah, that's a typical robin song. There's a crow there as well. Crow sings generally four. Three or four calls. It's two woodpeckers.
How many varieties would you expect to hear on average this time of year?
A dozen. And that's a goldcrest, I think. They never stop goldcrests. Yeah, they know. They're very often found in mixed flocks with blue tits, great tits, cold tits. And if we're exceptionally lucky, unless a spotted woodpecker.
And are these territorial songs?
No. These blue tits are in a group and they'll be mixing with other birds and they're going around. They use the company for protection. If a hawk comes, they'll all start making a certain noise which says hawk. And they protect each other that way. Oh, that's a green woodpecker. Did you hear it? Green woodpecker. Laughing, they call it.
It does sound like they're laughing.
I think there's a great tit up there. Can you hear the more strident note? That.
Ah.
I think that's a great tit.
Is there anything here that isn't very common, or would people be able to hear this sort of thing in any wood?
I think so. What we've heard so far.
Yeah.
I mean, we might have got more of them, perhaps, than some. Field fares. They're winter visitors. It's the first I've seen. I've been looking out for them since the 1st of January. They're on the move because they're migratory birds. That's the field fares. And the redwings, when they get into a big party, they have a kind of little whistle.
There's lots of them. There's going to be about 10, 15 flying into that oak tree and then swooping along the ground. Starlings as well.
So they've been dropping in and they're feeding on the ground. Field fares have a grey rump. There's a lot of field fares there. think it's a jay. Quite the right noise. Yeah, it's a jay. Teacher, teacher, teacher. Mm. The great tip male has a thick black stripe and the female has a thinner black stripe. Not very obvious, but it's the males that sing. That's great. It's made my day.
That was Nick Lear there. I love that. It made my day. It was lovely to go out for a little walk with him in January. And like I said before, that clip, it's just that thing of getting out when we think it's cold and we're all in hibernation, but there's still so much going on and it's really exciting. And this really special thing happened, which I didn't actually manage to catch on audio, but a barn owl flew out of this nesting box as we were walking up to a tree, just as Nick was saying, oh, I've never seen anything in those boxes. You know, they look rather nice, but I'm not sure they're actually very useful. And that very moment, this huge barn owl swept out and flew straight past us. It was quite special. Okay, so staying in the kind of woodland vibe, which is, my favourite place to hang out, we're going to revisit Tristan Gooley. He is the natural navigator that we spoke to back in May. You can tell because he was referencing the bluebells that were very much out in the woods that I went to visit him in. So he's a natural navigator. He uses the signs that nature tells us in a way that enables us to find our way. And this is him explaining a little bit more about that whole process.
The way I see everything outdoors is absolutely everything is a sign. It can be a sign in a crude sense. It might point north or south for us, like the North Star pointing north, obviously, or the sun in the middle of the day is pointing south. But that's quite crude. I like the sort of rich tapestry approach. So one of the most interesting areas of natural navigation is the idea that everything in the landscape is making a map. So if we take the bluebells, they are suggesting that we're in chalk country, which in turn is saying there probably isn't much water around. So for most people who are new to this way of looking at a landscape, it can start with the, you know, as I say, the quite sort of blunt stuff. Okay, that shape of a tree is telling me that south is this way, you know, but that's part of a much, much richer, broader way of looking at the outdoors. If we just have a look along this path here, one of the keys to natural navigation is asymmetry. No two sides of anything in nature are identical. And we can see that there's a sign here. It's been a very dry spell recently, but we can see there have been a lot more puddles along this side than this side. And this isn't, again, there's very, very little that, if anything, that's random outdoors. We get more puddles on the south side because, on average, there will be more shadows on the south side. So if we have a look just here, can you see it's slightly darker mud?
Yeah.
So I won't make you get your hands dirty, but there, that's all soft and squidgy.
Oh, yeah.
Whereas this here, the light colour, that's not giving way at all. And that's all because we're just getting a bit more shade on this side and on the southern side. And that's a south-north indication. And once you can see it, it's there.
You
it's
can't
almost,
not see yeah, it. Yeah. That's so. I've never thought of that. I've never noticed that. That's really interesting.
Fun, isn't it?
Yeah.
Under a cloudy sky, we start to notice, oh, yeah, I felt the breeze is coming from the west, and it's been on my left cheek for the last half an hour. Then even when it clouds over a bit, you've got some bearing. You've got some indication of which way's which. But you're so much more tuned into that breeze. It starts to have real meaning and, yeah, it has a gravity. So we've got a scattering of different tree types. We've got a few birches, which is, again, can be used both as a compass. They like lots and lots of light, so you tend to find them places where the sun can get to. They're more common on the south side of forests, but they're much stronger indicators of actually of colonization, i.e. areas they've been cleared recently. So again, if you're in the heart of a wood and you're completely lost and you want to try and find the edge of it, as long as you can hold some sort of direction using sun, moon, stars, wind, all sorts of things, you'll notice at some point the trees change, and the trees are telling you you're getting to the edge of the woodland, because any colonising trees like birches start to pop up before you reach the edge of the woodland.
To tune into nature in that way, why is that important for us, do you think?
One of the things almost everybody feels at some point is that they don't lose anything by noticing stuff and understanding things. So, you know, there are all sorts of regrets that we can have in life, but I've never come across somebody who says, hey, well, it was a real shame I noticed things and understood what was going on.
So true there, Tristan, so true. That was another brilliant day, and I would encourage you to listen to that whole interview if you can track back and find it on the podcast from a few months ago. In fact, that's the same with all of these interviews, actually, and little packages. The full versions do them a lot more justice. It's quite hard to distill down into these smaller things. But Tristan's written so many different books, and if you are interested, then have a look. I will, of course, be putting links to all of these folk up on the Growing Wild show page. We've got a new website at Radio Reverb. It's very fancy, so hopefully it won't get hacked quite so many times as the last one did. Okay, we're going to have a song, and then we're going to visit a community garden. But this is You Think I Don't Know by Charles Bradley. That was Charles Bradley and You Think I Don't Know. You're listening to Radio Reverb. I am Charlotte Petz. This is Growing Wild, and it is sponsored very generously by Infinity Foods. So a couple of months back, I went along to a project called Plot 22. It's a community project, and it's run by Emma Holdsworth. And it's one of those things that I'm just so impressed with, that people have this passion and they create projects like this and just give back so much. I love going to community gardens. They're absolutely one of my favourite things. And I'm always trying to get people to help out and volunteer and just hear how much value folk seem to get from being part of one. Plot 22 was really, it really was a joy to visit. And I'm aiming to go back in the new year to cover their dementia gardening projects, which I think sound brilliant. So let's hear from Emma as she took me on a tour of the site, which is in Portslade in Brighton. And this is her explaining how she got into it in the first place.
Just recently qualified in as a therapist, and I'd got a background in working with people who were experiencing homelessness, and so all of those threads came together, and it began, and that was in 2010. And then later on we got our second site, and then recently we've been able to join them together, and so that means that we've got a decent amount of space to grow vegetables, to have a fruit garden, herb garden, and a social space to enjoy cooking and eating it and hanging out together.
Let's have a little walk through this little tunnel. What is that? Is that willow?
It's hazel. It's a mixture of silver birch, hazel. Yeah, lots of hazel, and but mostly bindweed holding it together now, I think.
Shh, no one can see that.
It's changed over the years a little bit, depending on kind of capacity and funding. And at the moment, we've got a regular women's session every Thursday, and that they're like the main caretakers of the space. And many of those women have been coming for several years. And then we have a monthly dementia-inclusive gardening session for people living with dementia and their carers. We've got a grow and play session in the wings. It's several years we ran a group for parents and preschool children, and that's kind of coming back now, happily funded by the Co-op supermarket. What else? And we've got a Friends of Plot 22 project. So that's been crowdfunded, and everyone who's contributed to that crowdfund can come along and bring guests.
What do you see happening to the people that come here?
I think everyone says how much more relaxed they feel almost as soon as they arrive. And they use words like haven, oasis, peaceful. So I think it has that really profound effect on how they feel. And everyone says they feel better when they leave.
Yeah, so even if it's just for that moment, mm-hmm. just to get that even half an hour of yeah. just some peace amidst something out when you step back out through the bindweed pergola.
Yeah, yeah.
But maybe it comes back again. It's just provides some respite.
Absolutely. Yeah, I think just being amongst the elements, being among a living environment that and with very little demands on you. I mean, it can be really tough for people to get here. That's a quite a big step. Just getting here, committing to come, but I think once you do, the rewards are so great that that's what makes people want to come back again and again, and a lot of people do come very regularly for a long period of time, and I think that's also a really key thing, is getting to know people over time.
So we've got strawberries.
So we've got strawberries.
Currants.
Currants. Behind you, raspberries, and then we're going to walk through an archway of cherry trees. Very influenced by permaculture principles. And I really liked the simplicity of their earth care, people care, fair share, because it really encapsulates that the wholeness of what we're trying to do here. So that's been a kind of touchstone to go back to all the time. And the idea of not fighting nature, but being in harmony with it and considering all the factors, you know, sharing the space with the living creatures and trying to work with nature rather than against it, definitely. I think what I've really realised and what I've really enjoyed about it is helping other people realise their ambitions and their dreams through it. So if people come along and they get to know the space and they garden and they've got a wish themselves to work with other people outdoors, then if we can make that happen through this space, then that's just brilliant. And that's been such a privilege to be part of those journeys as well.
One thing I really noticed is how it encompasses all ages. You're talking about nippers, yeah. and then you've got the other end of the spectrum with yeah. dementia gardening.
Yes.
And that's the beauty of gardening, isn't it? And growing, it's for everybody.
Absolutely. And it reflects every kind of challenge in life, I think. You can find the kind of equivalent in the garden, and I think that's another therapeutic benefit of gardening, is that, you know, new things are always germinating and other things are dying, and it's that process is happening all the time, and there's things to harvest and fruits to enjoy and then there's tidying up to do and clearing. So it reflects all of that we have to do in our own lives as well, and I think that's the universalness of it.
Yeah. And letting the art of compromise.
Absolutely, yeah.
That was Emma from Plot 22. A truly, absolutely brilliant project. And again, I will put that link up on the show page if you are interested. They're always looking for help and donations as well. These things do take money to continue to run. And they're just so important. There's so many disadvantaged folk in the community that really, really benefit from that project. A thread that's run through all of the last three clips seems to be kind of slowing down, paying attention, learning from around us and learning from nature. And that just seems to be a thread that runs through the show all the time, really. And someone else who I spoke to this year who feels this really keenly in the water is Vivian Rickman-Paul. I spoke to her on the Wild Swimming episode. She's based up in Snowdonia and she photographs herself in these bodies of water, and she's kind of made it her life's work to try and get into every body of water in the Snowdonia National Park. I think it's over 400 and she's on about 130 or so. So I had a chat and really got into how her love of water came about and why it's such an important part of her life.
I've always done ever, you know, since I can remember. Mum was a swimmer from the days when swimming, you swam outside because you had no other choice. I think they had a harbour pool they might have swum in. She just made sure we always swam, and you know, like everyone did, if summers were spent at the beach or in river pools or an old gravel pit we used to swim in the forest. And yeah, as I got older, I just sort of, you know, grew out of it a bit. And then my mum passed away, and I didn't notice. It was totally subconscious that I was swimming more and more after she passed away. And I did a film for Elbow for one of their singles. And it wasn't until we were making that film that it came out that it was possibly why I was swimming so much, was because, you know, my mum had passed away.
Mm.
So
it's actually, it's been a bit of a healing experience,
yeah,
in a way?
Yeah, I mean, I don't, if it was, it was totally subconscious.
Yeah.
But yeah. I swim a lot alone, but I don't, you know, while I'm swimming, I'm not thinking about my mum or anything like that.
Yeah.
But I do, because I think when you're swimming, I'm just in the moment, you know, I'm just thinking about my next time I've got to put my head up to breathe and that kind of thing. But the taking photos came about because I've always messed about with cameras and being experimental with, you know, making pinhole cameras. And at some point, the swimming started to get quite obsessive. And with all art, you know, all creativity and the subject that you're interested in, I find that for it to be really meaningful, it ends up being all-encompassing in your life.
Mm.
And at some point, the cameras went in the water with me, and that's when it all took over and became encompassing. I did an article for Elementum Journal, and I was talking to, I'm not a great speaker, but I was talking to the editor. She helped write the article, and it was in, she picked up on this sort of swimming for healing, or, I mean, I don't like the word healing particularly, but yeah, she picked up on the fact that I was swimming alone and wanting to sort of capture the being alone in the water, and she picked up on the maybe it was something connection to my mum, you know.
Mm. So, yeah, because that it's very striking in your images. I've got to say, I've picked up on that. It's very, it looks like you use it very much for time that you've carved out for yourself, you know, just to have some space. And it seems quite almost expansive in a way. It's like it looks like you breathe in the water. There's I don't know, like a spaciousness about you. Would that be fair to say?
Yeah, absolutely. And I'm actually, this is getting really deep. I'm a twin, but I've lost my twin. She was, I don't even know if it was a she. She was born early and didn't make it. It's almost like I'm trying to create, through self-portraits, trying to create an image of a double of myself, like almost embryonic. Healing, grieving process is there again. Because me being interested in my twin came up when my mum passed away.
Okay.
Yeah.
But I do find, so something about the water. For me, it's I'm going out a lot more and spending time in the water a lot more. And, yeah, wild swimming is becoming quite a large part of my life, actually. And I'm finding it quite emotional. And and there's something in learning to trust the water, that it holds you. If you stop sort of flailing around and thinking, oh, it's getting it up my nose or whatever, when you can be so still, it's such a minimal movement to stay afloat. And there's something in that change of mindset. I don't know, it feels quite, it really resonates. It goes quite deep.
I sometimes have this absolute craving to have the pressure of the water around me.
Mm.
And it's almost like being cuddled by the water.
And
I don't have any desire to dive into the water. I quite like my head above it. But I like that feeling that my body is immersed in it.
Yeah.
You know, I like to have my shoulders under. And it's the cool. The coldness is quite a big thing for me as well. I like the coolness all over me, and enveloped in the water.
Enveloped.
Good.
So a question that I've found that comes up quite a lot when you talk about going out in open water is the fear of what might lurk beneath.
I mean,
we've all watched Jaws. I know, right? Even in swimming pools, I can get that feeling. You know, oh gosh, what if it bursts through the wall? Completely irrational. But it does. I think we all saw it at a tender age, and it seems to have affected us. Have you had to overcome those thoughts, or do you get freaked out by something brushing your leg ever, or?
All the time. One of the reasons that I started taking a camera in the water was for that very reason, was that I was petrified of, you know, everything. And I'd rush home to have a look at the photos and then find out there was nothing, absolutely
nothing. There's
nothing
there, yeah.
I mean, I didn't used to lift my eyes underwater because I was frightened. You know, every kind of thing that moves, you know, would throw me into, like, fits of screaming.
It's our imagination, isn't it? That's almost the biggest thing.
Totally.
That's the biggest thing we have to overcome is what we bring to it ourselves.
I've developed a love for deep water, which is quite unusual because most people like to stay in the shallows because they feel safe. But for me, that's where the beasties live, in the shallows. That's where we're going to see fish and things. Mm. Whereas in the deep water, it's just an empty abyss of nothingness, ooh, which is what I like looking at. But a lot of people hate that. So we're all different, aren't we?
We got such a great response to that interview because she was just so honest, because you could feel how important it was for her to be in the water and to have those experiences. She's been massively inspiring for me, actually, and I've got into wild swimming in a way I never have before and become slightly obsessed with the whole thing. So she was on the wild swimming episode. There was lots of other great stuff on that show. And again, that's you can find that as a podcast if you trek back through iTunes or Audio Boom or through the Radio Reverb page. As a result of getting more into swimming and enjoying all of our wild waters, you also, unfortunately, realise the problem of pollution in those waters, and especially plastics. I mean, this is a huge problem. It's a very on-trend subject at the moment, which is brilliant because people are starting to realise how much of an issue it actually is. And just needing to reduce plastic in our everyday life generally. And just such a huge amount ends up in the oceans. I know that Blue Planet did their episode just recently. And the fact that they've got plastics in the deep sea, which is, you know, so remote from any population, civilization. And yet plastic's still getting out there. It kind of highlighted actually how much of a huge problem it was. And I made a show about it when I started to realise all of these things and spoke to some incredible women who were all trying to make a difference around that subject. And one of those people was Claire Potter. And just some of the facts that she said, I think, really show the extent of the problem that we're dealing with. So it was a bit of a shocker. So I just wanted to replay those because it kind of set the tone for that show. So this is Claire and her plastic facts.
Unless we have incinerated it, every single piece of plastic we have ever made on this planet is still here. I think one of the wonderful quotes is somebody said, you know, so we've dug up a fossil fuel to frack it, to add stuff to it, to mould it into a plastic spoon, to ship it from one side of the world to the other. And that is cheaper and easier than just having a stainless steel one that you put in a washing up bowl.
Wow.
And you think about it in that capacity, you think, yeah, that's quite bonkers, actually. About 8 million tonnes of plastic per year globally end up in our oceans. It is absolutely staggering, and it equates to about a garbage truck's full of plastic per minute. That's just how much is being generated, right? Or it ends up being in the water in different ways. 80% of marine litter comes from land. We know it's coming directly from land. It's not coming off a boat. It's not a remnant of something else. It is coming directly from land.
Yeah, it's quite a shocker, those things. It woke me up anyway. Claire's launched this great project called Plastic Free Pledge, and it's just trying to eliminate single-use plastics, you know, and her main focus is on straws, and she's got the tagline, straws are for suckers, and is going around and trying to get restaurants and bars to stop using single-use plastic straws because they are so lightweight. They get caught by the wind, and which often means anything that can happen to ends up in water. So check that out, Plastic Free Pledge, and I will put that again on the show page. Also from that show were Bex and Erin, who went out on their kayaks with a group of women and kayaked from Bristol to London and picked up all of the plastic that they could along the way. And that little adventure, that was brilliant. They got so much out of the water and raised awareness massively. So again, check out that episode. It's very inspiring. I use that word a lot on this show, but honestly, I just sit here and just think, wow, people are brilliant. Okay, let's have another song. And then we're going to revisit Susanna and her lambs.
Up on the roof. When this old world starts getting me down,
And people are just too much for me to face. I climb way up to the top of the stairs, and all my cares just drift right into space.
I was Up on the Roof by the Drifters. Okay, so someone who I've revisited a couple of times is Susanna Alse and her Barkham Romneys, because it's rather delightful, really. She represents a smallholder, somebody who has worked as a shepherdess for a lot of years, but then recently just got her own flock. And it's been really fascinating to learn the struggles and highlights and lowlights of doing that, and of maintaining a healthy flock, and what it is to rear your own animals. So I thought we'd revisit and listen to that an original clip where I went there during lambing season and watched some little lammies get freshly born.
I've always done indoor lambing from the age of 18. And then one year I went and worked on a really big farm in Storrington, and they had like 3,000 outside lambing Romneys, which this is what these are. And it just completely changed my mind. It was amazing. We went to bed at night, top of the morning. And out here, there aren't really very many bugs in the ground. If you're lambing inside, all your time is spent sort of faffing with things and looking at things, bedding things up, mucking things out, feeding things. You have to sort of make sure the lambs don't get mismothered. They can get in a muddle because they're close together. There's more chance of them picking up infections and bugs because they're on that same dirty ground. Out here, especially these sheep, they've got 20 acres up here, about that. It's much cleaner, it's much easier, they can pick their own space. The only trouble you get is if you've got one that's lambing and it's in a bit of difficulty. So I'm going to creep up and see if I can. She might just stay there.
So Susanna's just approached her with the crook and she stood up, which just means it looks like it's going to be a bit trickier to grab her. She's looking a bit anxious. So this is where the dogs come in, and they're just making a circle around her so she doesn't move away too far. It's running one way and then the other. The dogs have got her pretty well controlled, and now Susanna's just using the crook, and she's got her leg. Susanna's just got her on the floor, knee on the side, roll up sleeve, orange glove goes on.
All right, it's come a bit nearer.
It is all coming right, but since we've got her, we'll give her a little hand and then we'll know. She probably would have had this on her own in the next half an hour, but I can feel the sort of tight rings where it's the first time she's had a lamb. It'll be fine. I'm going to give her a little pull.
Is that the face? That's the face.
Little nose.
It's amazing.
I don't really want to pull the legs all the way out, because as soon as it goes like a dive rather than with its feet under its chin, that's a much bigger space around its head and its shoulders, a much bigger, you know, shape to come out. What I can do is I can get behind its head from outside and give it a little squeeze as well, but we won't rush it. She's not in distress or anything, really, this lamb.
No. So how awake is that lamb now?
Well, it hasn't taken a breath yet. It's still living through its umbilical cord. So it's quite safe at the moment. Yeah, if this was a really difficult birth and it went on and on for ages, you'd start worrying that its head was going to get, swollen and things like that.
Oh, look, there he is. The whole head's come out and it's just taken its first breath. It's like a hiccup.
Here he comes.
And there it is, there's the lamb. A little cough.
It is a boy. Oh, it's a smashing lamb.
Then we just back away and let them get on with it. Oh, I love doing that. I loved being there. That was so wonderful. You can find out more about her and her work on previous shows. And I'll put a link up on about her website. It's such a delight getting to visit these people and have those experiences. Okay, so next up, I wanted to revisit Alice Bettany. She's a herbalist based in Sussex, and she's just so passionate about growing herbs for our health, and is one of those people that's just really found her vocation in life. This is me visiting her site out in Horam in Sussex back in spring and having a little taste of what the garden had to offer. It's a lovely view. We're on a bit of a slope and it looks out over quite a large body of water. And this is your outdoor herb garden.
Yeah, so the site used to be a brickwork, so there's lots of free materials to use left over. Yeah, so I got lots of free bricks from a field over there once the pigs have been in, and we've wheelbarrowed them over, and I'm building a spiral bed over there. And I've got a new experimental Hugel bed at the end there as well.
What's a Hugel bed?
A Hugel bed is a German invention where it's basically like a sandwich of different ingredients. Like kind of have a base of ash or cardboard and quite thick logs, very dead wood in the middle, and then just piling it up with any debris you've got. Lots of manure, lots of leaves or twigs or anything to kind of fill all the gaps in. So it's really, really heavy on material. But the idea is that it generates a bit of heat, and all of that is going to compost down eventually. So it kind of feeds everything that you put into that bed. And also, because it's very high, it kind of comes up to my waist almost. The idea is that you've got sort of double the surface area, because you can grow down both sides.
Oh, wow.
So for small gardens, it's a really good idea.
Okay, let's keep walking around.
We have got two plants here that are both in my respiratory wellness tea blend. This one is hyssop. So this is a very, very hot herb. It's got a really strong smell. Yeah, so hyssop, it has quite a strong flavour actually, and you can feel the heating in your chest as you drink a tea from it. This one is catnip, and it doesn't need to be crushed so much. It smells really strong anyway.
Woo!
Because obviously most people know it because they give it to their cats as a special treat. Mm-hmm. Has that sort of soporific, lie down, roll over, go crazy kind of effect on the cats. But it's really calming for humans, and we would use it particularly for children with respiratory issues. So someone that was coughing a lot, that had a sore throat, that was prone to ear, nose and throat issues. So it's a perfect remedy for adults and children as well. I really like it. It's quite lemony. And actually, we've got lemon balm here. I think we'll make ourselves a wild tea while we're at it. So we'll get some lemon balm, some catnip, maybe some fresh nettle. That'll be a nice blend. The nettles are just perfect for harvesting at the moment. They are ripe and succulent and green, and they're probably one of my favourite, most abundant spring medicinals right now. And it's so densely nutrient rich, iron and protein and minerals, and but also use it for allergies. So if someone was prone to hay fever, you would start taking medicine sort of prophylactically kind of now to lead up to the time where all the pollens are going to come out. So my favorite hay fever blend would be nettles, elderflower and plantain.
We've taken refuge even in the yurt.
It's a multi-purpose, beautiful, round-shaped yurt.
And we're going to use it for the purpose of making tea.
So we've got catnip, lemon balm and nettle here, all of which were looking vibrant and green in the garden, so they seemed perfect to make some tea from. I've just got a hot flask of water, and we've just sort of picked the leaves and put them into the flask to let them macerate for a while. It smells fresh, doesn't
smells
it?
Fresh. It smells healthy.
Yeah, yeah. Yeah, let's give it a try. Cheers.
Cheers. That's really tasty.
Can't really beat a fresh herbal tea, really. It's such a good, useful way of getting herbs into your everyday life, really. I'd like to encourage everyone out there to go and pick a few nettle tops and dry them and, store them in a jar and just make your own fresh nettle tea whenever you like. It's just so simple. I actually issue quite a lot of my patients with foraging homework. I see people from a shepherd's hut at Wo Wo campsite,
and we're sort of surrounded by nature, and I'm like, you definitely need to drink nettle tea really regularly, or, you know, come and pick some sort of wild garlic and get those pungents circulating you, and encourage people to grow their own herbs in their garden as well, and to be more self-sufficient in their own medical needs. I feel like herbal medicine really is the medicine of the people, and that feeling of wanting people to take it back into their own hands. You know, I'm really happy to be a guide to help introduce people to the plants and to help them to know how to use it and what it's good for. But ultimately, my end goal for every patient that comes into me is to hand their health back to them.
That was Alice Bettany. You can find out more about her work on sacredseed.org.uk. She makes seasonal herb boxes and does consultations and all sorts. The last person we're going to hear from today is our resident gardener, Sophie Eliadis. She comes on a few times through the year. She's great, she's very knowledgeable, and she just makes me laugh. And we went off onto her allotment just a few weeks ago and had a look around at what she was growing and the sorts of things that you can be doing in autumn and why it's so lovely, really, to have an allotment plot. And her enthusiasm for it, I just think, comes over brilliantly. So this is me and Sophie on her plot, having a little tour around. You're our resident gardener.
Oh, yeah.
On Growing
Wild. Of course
I am.
Everyone should know me well.
I know.
Been on twice.
Had one question.
Woo!
Phoned in.
That was exciting.
There's no phone. That's right. That's emailed. As a gardener, you still decided that you would like to take on a plot.
Yeah.
It's substantial. What's the size of it?
Big. I think it's a 16 rod. So it's a full-size plot. I generally say it's like a long driveway doubled. That's my way of explaining it.
It's a lot of land to manage.
Yeah.
And I think when you get a plot, you really realise how much work has to go into it.
Yeah.
But you don't need to be a gardener to take on a plot. And I guess that's what I want people to be able to see, is that, you know, you can take this on. It does. And I think the beauty of allotments is they don't have to be pristine.
No, absolutely. That it's a different thing. I think that's what's been interesting for me as a gardener, is that, you know, I'm used to working on presentation, on making things look really sort of pretty, and maybe sometimes not worrying so much about the stuff behind that. Taking on the allotment this year has been a good learning process, because I have that initial anxiety about, oh god, it doesn't look great, like it's a bit sort of rough around the edges and the grass needs cutting, and, you know, there's weeds, even though they're really quite small weeds, I'm still a bit like, oh no.
It's
a completely different, it's farming really, it's micro farming.
You've had it for a year. What have you been able to grow and achieve in your first year?
Oh, wow. We've had a really, really successful year. What have we done? I'm just walking up. So we had salads, kale, we've had loads of beetroot, we've had rocket, we've had Cavolo Nero, we've had loads of interesting sort of pumpkins, we've had these little patty pan squashes, which have been amazing, we've had radishes... We've had some slightly disappointing onions, but we're going to give them another go. We've had tons
Always
of potatoes.
Tricky.
Yeah, they are, aren't they?
You
I didn't realise.
It's the size of them. That
yeah.
Yeah.
No, they've been... I mean, they tasted amazing, but they were basically just... We just sort of stored the onion sets in the ground and then pulled them up again. It was a bit funny, really. But they were really lovely. We've had...
It's a lot.
Tomatoes. We've had aubergines. I'm still going.
Yeah.
We've had 5 different kinds of bean. We've had raspberries. We've had sweet peas. We've got sprouts and cabbages. Yeah, we've had tons.
It's incredible. In year one.
Yeah, year
and,
one.
And that's just sort of being determined putting the groundwork in at this time of year. And
exactly.
then and setting yourself up for the next year.
You know,
and do you find the other people who have other plots are helpful as well?
So
if you turned up, you don't really have any experience, you're like, wow, I've just taken on quite a large space.
Yeah.
Are other people here approachable and helpful?
So nice. And you know, we are 2 women and we're both quite small. And, you know, I was worried at first that we might be sort of patronised. But, you know, it's a predominantly, there's a lot of men, I think, mainly on this allotment. And I was a bit worried about that, you know, that they're all mainly older, retired white guys. And I was like, oh, you know, maybe they might be a bit patronising, or they might just not be that friendly, or they might be trying to help but actually end up doing things for us, which is a bit, you know, disempowering. But nothing like that has happened. Everyone has been incredibly supportive. We've been lent things, we've been shown how to do stuff, but in a really positive way. They've always said, just ask. So yeah, I literally could not have been happier with the community on the allotment. It's just incredible.
Do you think, will you manage it differently for next year? Will you sort of grow fewer of one variety?
Yes.
And just try and grow more sort of different.
Yeah. That's exactly what the plan is, yeah. I mean, this year we just were like, what should we do? Let's get this bits and pieces. And we've tried to think, grow things that we knew would work, and that we could kind of rely on to be, you know, successful. But yeah, this year we're going to, well, next year we're going to go really experimental, and we're going to get a load of seeds from, you know, real heirloom varieties of things and try stuff out. But obviously we've got two greenhouses as well, so we're going to try and do some salads and some pak choy in the greenhouse.
Should we go in here?
Lovely little tomatoes. I'd love a tomato.
These ones are nice. Mmm. They're good, aren't they? These ones are
oh, it's
waste
so delicious.
Of bloody time. The yellow plum tomatoes are absolutely boring as hell. Mm-hmm. They don't taste of anything. I love coming down here and just eating. Like, sometimes I come down here for lunch. And I'll just have, like, in the summer, I'd have, like, tomatoes, basil, salad, rocket, two cucumbers. They're amazing. Mmm.
That was Sophie Eliadis, and we were out on her allotment plot out over in Portslade in Brighton. I just want to say a huge thank you to everyone that's been on over this past year. And I really genuinely would, if there were time on the show, I would have made mini clips of everybody. I'm always slightly surprised when people say yes, that they'll come on the show, and 98% of the time they do. And the feedback I get from listeners about these things is just lovely. It's been such a good year doing this show, and it actually culminated in me winning an award at the Garden Media Awards for the Alan Titchmarsh New Talent Award, which was a bit of a surprise. And I was up at the Savoy Hotel and, having a lovely dinner. And I was sort of halfway through my creme brulee and they called out my name. And, very surprised. It was a wonderful experience, and I feel really grateful to have won. So thank you to the Garden Media Guild for that. And to all of you that listen and make this such an enjoyable show to make. Okay, we've come to the end of this highlights package show. I promise I really wanted to make this show, and it wasn't just because I had hurt my back and was laid out for a week and couldn't actually move anywhere. You can get in touch with me via Instagram and Twitter at GrowingWildFM. You can email the show on growingwildreverb@gmail.com. And you can get in touch via the Radio Reverb website. If you search for the show, there's a contact sheet on there. I will be back next month after all of the Christmas madness. This is Radio Reverb on 97.2 FM. The show is sponsored by Infinity Foods. I'm Charlotte Petz. Thank you for listening. I'm going to play you out with a song by The Specials, one of my faves, A Message to You, Rudy. I'll be back next month. Until then, go well. See you next time. We'll be right back.